The new film Bad Teacher centers on a woman who teaches children who would be too young to see this movie. It's an R-rated comedy starring Cameron Diaz as, well, a bad teacher. Directed by Jake Kasdan, it also stars Justin Timberlake and Jason Segel as an out-of-shape gym teacher. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Bad Teacher is a raunchy comedy about a conniving, alcoholic, druggy middle school teacher played by Cameron Diaz, who'll do anything to get the money to buy herself some bigger breasts so she can marry rich and not have to do the job at which she's, yes, bad. How bad is she? I won't give away specifics, but every scene is contrived to make you say, "That is a bad teacher," much as another R-rated film about someone not living up to the responsibility of interacting with children, Bad Santa, made you say, "That is a bad Santa." So the movie is one broad joke on the theme of how bad is she, repeated over and over, and most of the early reviews have complained about its coarseness and vulgarity. My response is easily stated. Get off your high horses. Bad Teacher made me laugh harder than anything this year outside Broadway's The Book of Mormon, which is filthier and still won the Tony. As Elizabeth Halsey, Cameron Diaz does not walk when she can sashay, and almost always in short, tight dresses and stiletto heels. She looks, frankly, used. Dissipated, hungover, her makeup smeared, her wide mouth looking unusually lewd. She's wonderful. But then she's often wonderful, despite recent high-profile embarrassments like Night and Day opposite Tom Cruise, mugging it up and trying too hard to be funny. Diaz doesn't need to mug. Her great big features are gorgeous and clown-like at once. As Bad Teacher opens, Elizabeth is departing John Adams Middle School, where she's been teaching for a year without even learning the names of her students, a matter of crushing indifference to her given her coming marriage to a rich boy. Alas, he dumps her, or rather, his mother insists he dump her, for racking up staggering monthly credit card bills. So it's back to bad teaching. On her return to the school in the fall, Elizabeth comes face to face with her opposite number, played by the brilliant British actress Lucy Punch, often a sex pod in movies, but here the soul of primness.
There she is! Elizabeth Halsey! Woo! I am so excited we're going to be across the hall, mates, but I am so sad it's because your relationship ended.
Who are you again?
Amy Squirrel.
Squirrel?
Yeah, you know. Don't worry, you were kind of a lone wolf last year and so busy planning the
wedding. I found him in bed with somebody
else. Oh my
gosh. It was another man.
Shut the front door.
That lie about him being with a man? It evolves the more she tells it, you can imagine. Or maybe not. What Bad Teacher most reminds me of is old Bill Murray comedies like Stripes or Meatballs, but with a woman talking dirty and using everything in her arsenal to get what she wants, cheating, lying, and being incorrigibly sleazy and opportunistic in the great American degenerate movie huckster tradition. There's a Bill Murray figure here, too, a pudgy pothead gym teacher played by Jason Segel, who watches her with amusement, admiration, and unconcealed lust. One thing, though, as taken as he is by her gonzo ways, he doesn't collude in her bad teaching. He thinks she should do something else. Although Elizabeth isn't punished for breaking almost every law there is, ethical and legal, she's not rewarded either. Where she ends up is very satisfying, even touching. Director Jake Kasdan loves his actors and gives them room to breathe, and in some cases, hyperventilate, along with sterling turns by Diaz, Segel, Lucy Punch, and Phyllis Smith from The Office as Elizabeth's mousy colleague. Justin Timberlake defies expectations as an insipid little bespectacled nerd with a fortune from his family's watch business, a performance of gentle weirdness that builds to a non-sex sex scene with some of the most inspired nerdy-dirty language I've ever heard. I've missed Gonzo. I don't mean fake Gonzo, like the Judd Apatow movies in which child men act out before they have to grow up, or swill like the Hangover films that reinforce American male's sense of entitlement. Bad Teacher, like Bad Santa, is blessedly free of redeeming social value.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.
With the debt ceiling debate at an impasse and lawmakers flirting with financial disaster, who's for real, who's posturing, and who might actually blink? Some good questions for our regular political observers, David Brooks of the New York Times and E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. Good to see you both.
Good to be with you.
First, David Brooks, you were the pessimist here last week. You said that you would expect significant defaults, crack-ups, and a semi-government shutdown. I'm quoting right now. E.J., you expected they'd actually make a deal sometime before early August. So, first, each of you, David first, with an added week of wisdom, does it still look the same way to you? And who, if anybody, is stronger than somebody else in this argument?
Yeah, I didn't even mention the explosion of planet Earth. I'm still a long-term pessimist. I think there's a significant chance we'll have some default, we'll have a government shutdown, we'll have a real crisis within the next few months. I'm a short-term optimist, though. I don't think what happened this week was particularly bad.
The walkout by
the walkout was a necessary
Cantor?
Gesture.
Mm-hmm.
What the Republican needed, they needed Obama to get involved. They needed him to issue a public plan that he would publicly endorse, because otherwise the Republicans are afraid that they will make some tough votes and then he'll walk out and leave them hanging. So they needed him to take a step, and this gesture was really about making them take a step. The longer-term reason for pessimism is about taxes. Will Republicans accept any revenue increases? And that, I think, they still don't know the answer to.
Is that a tough vote or an absolutely impossible vote for Republicans?
Well, I think for a third of the Republicans in the Senate and probably 60% in the House, it's an impossible vote. But there are a lot of Republicans in both bodies for whom it's a tough and terrible vote, but one they're willing to take.
E.J. Dionne, try and be optimistic this week.
Well, I do think there's posturing within posturing, and it's hard to sort out how many layers of costumes there are here. I think this week the Republicans walking out at this point was pretty irresponsible. They were actually making progress in identifying cuts, and it's very strange that but actually a pattern here, which is Obama makes a lot of concessions to the Republicans. They pocket them and say bipartisanship is whatever we say it is. Now, in the long run, I guess I'm optimistic only because I really don't think John Boehner wants to crack up the economy by missing the debt ceiling deadline, and somehow they're going to pull it out. But what happened this week doesn't make it easier. And I think the president is going to have to come out and start making a case for what it is he wants out of this deal.
And really, he's going to have to stand by tax increases.
He's got to say
firm line that he supports.
Yes, I think he's got to say you cannot do this without some increase in revenue. And because that's true, and it is the only way I think he's going to rally Democrats. Democrats in the Congress are very worried that he'll just agree to a slew of cuts without any tax increases at all.
He's got to do something. You know, I talked to Chris Christie, the governor of Jersey, today. Whether you like what he did or not, he was governor. He said, I'm out front. I'm going to have a huge education campaign, town hall meetings, charts. Here's my plan. This is what I stand for. That is leading from the front. The president has been remarkably passive on this issue for a long time, and I think it's hurt both parties.
It's hard to project what the political consequences would be of a federal government default if it came to that, because we have no experience of this. But does either side shape up to be especially the winner or the loser if it comes to that?
One of the fascinating things about this whole deal is both parties think the political landscape is tilted in their favor. The Republicans believe, hey, the public does not want to raise the debt ceiling. This is our moment of leverage. The Democrats believe this is our moment of leverage. What we're going to do come August is we're going to pay off our creditors, but we'll send out letters to all Pell Grant recipients and Social Security recipients saying, sorry, we can't afford to pay you. It's those Republicans' fault. So they think they have the advantage. I think the Democrats are actually a little more right on this.
I do think, however, that economic catastrophe, it happens under President Obama, and therefore he is likely to get more of the blame. And what you're seeing is a lot of nervous Democrats saying, why aren't we doing more to goose the economy? Economic pessimism is going up, not down, as they needed to before the election. So you actually had Democrats in the Senate this week essentially accusing Republicans of trying to sabotage the economy. The Democrats want to have a payroll tax cut, want to extend the payroll tax cut. Republicans are resisting it. And Senator Chuck Schumer in New York actually went out there and said it almost makes you wonder if they aren't trying to slow down the recovery for political gain. I think you're going to see a lot more of that kind of argument.
Well, that's more or less an accusation of treason. I don't think that's responsible. I was for a payroll cut when we needed a stimulus. Now I think you'd have to have some long-term deficit reduction or a promise of deficit reduction to get a short-term payroll cut.
That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get the payroll tax into a budget deal.
In the minute remaining, I want to ask you about the presidential political field changing this week, the entry of John Huntsman. Is John Huntsman the fresh face the GOP has been waiting for, or is he just how you say Fred Thompson 2012?
No, he's better than Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson didn't
Everybody
want to run
thought
for president.
Fred Thompson was going to save the Republican
Party. They thought Fred Thompson was better than Fred Thompson.
You've got somebody who wants to run for president, not somebody whose wife wants him to run for president. Huntsman, I think, is going to surprise people because John McCain won. There are a lot of independents. There are still a lot of moderates in the Republican Party. There's a path, maybe not to the nomination, but he will surprise people.
In New Hampshire, independents can vote in the Republican primary. In 2008, the independents were key to John McCain's victory, even though a lot of independents voted in the Democratic
because
primary.
Because there was a Democratic primary.
This time there is no Democratic primary. And so Huntsman, I think, can run a campaign that largely ignores the right wing of the party, let everybody else fight for them. And he has at least an outside shot. But I think David and I may be about two of the only people in Washington who think Huntsman has a chance.
Well, we didn't have time this week to talk about Afghanistan, but we have another year to do so.
or till 2014.
David Brooks and E.J. Dionne, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. 90,000 people are expected to fill the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, California tomorrow to watch the latest match in a long-running soccer rivalry, the United States against Mexico. The teams are meeting in the finals of the Gold Cup, and joining us to preview the game is sports writer Stefan Fatsis. Hi, Stefan.
Hey, Robert.
First of all, what's the Gold Cup?
It's the regional championship for the Caribbean and North and Central America, and it's held every other year. This one is big because the winner gets to play in the Confederations Cup in 2013, and that's a tune-up for the World Cup that'll be played the following year. But what's really at stake is national pride. There have been 24 games over the last 3 weeks in the United States. Stadiums have been packed, and that's largely because Hispanic fans turn out to support their countries. The Rose Bowl crowd is going to be pro-Mexico and raucous, and this really is one of the most intense international rivalries in all of sports, you can argue, and Mexico dominated it for decades. But since 2000, the U.S. has had the upper hand, especially when games are played in the United States.
Okay, well, let's hear about the two teams in the championship game. And first, the U.S., which players are people talking about?
Well, they're talking about the three American soccer players that most sports fans have heard of. They combined on the only goal in the semifinal win over Panama the other night in the Gold Cup. The scorer was Clint Dempsey. He just finished one of the best seasons ever by an American in Europe. And the assist on Dempsey's goal against Panama was from Landon Donovan, and he's the leading scorer in U.S. soccer history. But he came into that game as a substitute, which was surprising. I do think he's going to start tomorrow in the final. And then the pass to Donovan came from a player that many fans have probably forgotten about, Freddie Adu.
Yes, Freddie Adu, the one-time boy wonder of American soccer, went from being the future of the game to being a name out of the past. What happened in between?
Forgotten. He turned pro at age 14 with Major League Soccer. He was touted as the American Pelé. He signed a multi-million dollar endorsement deal with Nike. But he headed to Europe in 2007, and since then his career has just gone downhill. He's played for five different teams, the latest in the second division in Turkey. In retrospect, it was just too much too soon. He needed those teenage years to develop his skills and to mature. Instead, he was thrust into competing against men. But Freddie Adu is just 22. Going to that lower-level team in Turkey was seen by the U.S. coach Bob Bradley as a sign of his determination to revive his career, and he earned a spot on this Gold Cup roster. And he's so focused that he stopped tweeting.
Well, let's hear about the Mexican team. Who's the player to watch in Mexico?
Well, that's easy. It's Javier Chicharito Hernandez, the little P. He wears his nickname on the back of his jersey, and he's 1 year and 1 day older than Freddie Adu, but his career has only had an upward arc. He turned pro at 15. But in a soccer country, that didn't merit any national attention. He climbed through the Mexican Pro League, and last year he became the first Mexican player signed by the world power Manchester United in England. And Hernandez scored 20 goals in 45 games in his first season. Chicharito is super fast. He's strong. He's got 7 goals in 5 Gold Cup games. So watch for the little P.
So much for men's soccer. I gather that you're off to Germany tomorrow to watch some women's soccer.
Yes, I'm taking my daughter for what I hope will be a fun and inspiring couple of weeks in Germany at the Women's World Cup. The United States is one of the favorites, along with two-time defending champion Germany and Brazil. We'll be at the Americans' first game next Tuesday against North Korea in Dresden, and I hope we can talk afterwards.
I'll talk to you then. Have a great weekend, Stefan.
Thanks, Robert.
Stefan Fatsis, who joins us most Fridays to talk about sports and the business of sports. You can hear more of him on Slate Magazine's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The Gulf of Mexico just can't seem to catch a break. Following the damage wrought by the Deepwater Horizon spill last year, this spring brought flooding all along the Mississippi River Basin, and as you know, that water eventually flows to the Gulf, along with all the runoff, the garbage, whatever gets collected along the way. So we can add a forecast this summer that the dead zone in the Gulf will be bigger than ever this year. Joining me to talk about it is Nancy Rabelais. She is the director of Louisiana University's Marine Consortium. And among other things, she studies hypoxia in the Gulf. In more colloquial terms, she studies the Gulf's dead zone. Welcome back to the program.
Hello, Ara. Nice. Good afternoon. Nice to be back. It seems you only call me on disasters.
I'm sorry. I feel bad. But you are an expert in the Gulf, right? And
yes.
That seems to be where a lot of disasters are happening.
Yes, yes.
Tell us about what the dead zone is.
The dead zone's an area in the Gulf, a large area, especially larger this year, where there's not enough oxygen in the bottom for fish and shrimp and crabs to survive. So if they can swim, they'll swim out of the way. But otherwise, things that are stuck will suffocate and die. So it's just it's a large area where you just can't catch anything.
Wow. And how big an area this year are we talking about?
The prediction for this year is anywhere between 9,000 and 10,000 square miles, which is larger than we've ever had before, which was about 8,500 square miles. So in geography, it's about the size of New Jersey and Delaware combined, the state of Maryland, if you don't count Chesapeake Bay, and for landlubbers, it's more like Lake Erie.
Wow. Wow. Is it because of all the flooding that we've had into the Mississippi this year?
Absolutely. The river controls the physics and the biology of the Gulf of Mexico, and this one is, of course, a huge event, the largest discharge for a long, long time, the largest nitrate load for a long, long time, and all that combines to create the physical characteristics of the area, plus the nitrates are what start the whole thing off.
What whole thing? Tell us about the cycle that happens.
Well, the nutrients, primarily the nitrate, is mm-hmm. the issue, and they come in the spring, and we've been getting more and more of them, of course, this spring, as everybody else has their land flooded and their homes and businesses flooded. We're getting this extra boost of nitrogen into the Gulf. It makes the single-celled plants called phytoplankton. It makes them grow so much better, and not all of that is eaten by the food web, by the zooplankton. So a lot of it gets to the bottom, and once it gets to the bottom, bacteria eat it up, just like the bacteria ate up many of the hydrocarbons in the BP oil spill. The bacteria will do the same thing to this carbon in the area of the low oxygen.
And this is a forecast, and I know with the weather report,
right.
We've learned never to really trust the forecast till it's happening.
Well, this model that uses the amount of nitrate that comes in May explains about 70 to 80% of the variability in the size over the last 27 years now. So it's a pretty robust model, but we could have different weather patterns. We could have, hopefully not, but we could have a hurricane come through and mix it up before we go out to measure it.
Mm-hmm.
A hurricane, of course, is just a temporary fix because it'll set back up again.
How long will this last, this dead zone?
Well, we've already seen it earlier this year. We had a peak in the river in March. And we've had it from March through last week. We've already had it at many of our stations. And some of our regular stations that we go to last week were very, very low. Not just low, but close to zero.
Wow. So that means in this zone there are no shrimp, there are no fish.
That's right.
To be
now
caught.
there's oxygen at the surface, so there's fish at the surface, but the trawling industry, the brown shrimp, white shrimp industry in Louisiana, of course, depends on the bottom. So a trawler puts a net over when the oxygen's below 2. They just won't catch anything.
That is not good news.
No, it's not. And this is, as you mentioned, it's just another insult to the Gulf of Mexico following the disaster from the oil spill and now this. And fishers weren't able to fish last year, and oysters have been cut back by the freshwater this year, and there's a large area offshore where you can't catch shrimp. So it is a continuing unfortunate saga that we're going through.
You know, you began our interview, our conversation, by saying, you always talk to me only when there are bad things.
Right. The last one was the oil spill.
Can you give me a hopeful thing I can talk to you about the Gulf? Is there some good news here?
Well, the good news is that we do have fairly resilient ecosystems, and we do continue to have fish and shrimp despite everything that we do to the system. So that's the good news. Mm-hmm. And the river is very important with regard to all of that, because it brings the nutrients that we need to fuel the food web and get the fisheries, but we just have too much, and too much means we need to try to reduce that.
Hmm. Let's see if I can get a call in or two. Let's go to Jim in Sacramento. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi there.
Has anybody considered the possibility of injecting huge quantities of oxygen into the water to ameliorate the dead zone?
You mean like the bubblers you see in lakes and things like that?
Yeah.
Right. Well, people have suggested that with powering down air or using water circulation processes. But when you consider that this low oxygen spans from the Mississippi River from New Orleans all the way over to Galveston, Texas. That's a big aquarium, and you need a lot of air stones, and it just really physically cannot help.
And so there is really nothing you can do once it starts, and considering what happens with the volume of water and detritus that gets into the river upriver.
Right. Well, the solution is upriver. The solution is to curb the nutrients, the nitrogen upriver through best management practices, better wastewater treatment. The type of cars that people drive even affect it, because you get exhaust fumes and it comes back down as nitrate. So there are a lot of things people can do, but the primary, I don't want to say culprit, but the primary source is from agricultural activities.
Fertilizer.
Yeah, fertilizers. And this year, with all the extra water and more soil and dissolved nitrogen coming off the land, it can't help but create a larger low oxygen zone.
Does animal waste have anything to do with the runoff?
You mean like confined animal feed operations?
Yeah.
Definitely. That's one of the sources of nitrogen and phosphorus. Yeah.
Well,
that's part of the issue as well.
Well, Nancy, I want to thank you, you know.
Hey,
I guess.
Right. Well, you're very welcome, but, you know, If I have good news, I'm going to call you.
You have our number.
Okay.
All right. Thanks
all
a
right.
lot, man. Have a good weekend.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Nancy Rabelais is the director of the Louisiana University's Marine Consortium in Chauvin, Louisiana, and back with bad news about the dead zone in the Gulf this hour.